Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to New Books in the Indian Ocean World, a podcast series on the New Books Network. This podcast is for people who want to sail the waters of the expansive Indian Ocean and learn about its past and present. Thank you for joining me today. I'm your host, Ahmed Mazmi from Princeton University. Today, I'm here to talk to Professor Thomas Metcalf, the author of Imperial Connections, India and the Indian Ocean Arena between 1860 to 1920. Published by University of California Press in 2008. Thomas Metcalf is Emeritus Sarah Kailat Professor of India Studies and Professor of History at the University of California, Berkeley. He is the author of Forging the Raj, Ideologies of the Raj, An Imperial Vision, Indian Architecture, and Britain's Raj, with Barbara Metcalf, also A Concise History of Modern India. By discussing imperial connections, we will explore how India itself became a nexus of imperial power that made possible British conquest, control, and governance across a wide arc of territory stretching from Africa to Eastern Asia. Speaking from Kennington, Berkeley, welcome Professor Metcalf to New Books in the Indian Ocean World, and thanks so much for taking the time to talk about your book today. Can you please start us off by saying a few words about yourself that... Where did you grow up? Where you went to school? How you became interested in India and its colonial history? And any influential mentors that you had?
Yes, well, I grew up in upstate New York. My father was a corporate executive. But during the war, he was in the Second World War, he was in the Army. And I got interested in traveling and in seeing the various places he had been. And after the war, as the 1950s came on, I was a student, and I was just interested in history, and I was also interested in how America became such a predominant power in the world. It seemed that it was worth investigating how and why that had happened, and I turned to the study of Britain, because Britain had been the predominant power that the Americans had displaced in the 1940s. And I studied at the same time what I thought was one of the major features of British predominance, namely the power of English liberal ideology. Along with the Industrial Revolution, there was clearly also a political revolution, which was liberalism. And so I wrote my dissertation, my senior honors thesis in college on Gladstone, the famous British liberal prime minister. And then I decided I should know more about Britain. So I went to Cambridge for some graduate work. And the professor that I was assigned there, a man by the name of Ronald Robinson, said to me, you should study not just Britain, but the British Empire. And that struck me as being a very good idea, because part of what was made Britain the most powerful nation in the world was that it had lots of colonies. It had an empire, and they were quite upfront about that. But then I asked myself, but the British, I thought, believed in liberalism, which was individual freedom and so forth. And I said, how can you have an empire and be an advocate of liberalism and you know, freedom and all of that. And so my advisor said, well, that's a very good dissertation project. And I said, I should study some part of the empire in order to learn how the empire was connected to liberalism. And that turned out to be India. That was the biggest piece. Why not? I should study India. And so I spent my time writing a dissertation, which I attempted to find out how liberalism and empire could be connected together. And that led to my long-term interest, which is how far and in what ways we can talk about a liberal empire at all. And the more I got into this study, the more it seemed to me that India was a major place, not only for colonial rule, but also for expressing ideas of liberalism and empire. You can't run a big empire on one hand and proclaim liberalism on the other. So how did they make the two work together? Well, I found there was a very important shift about the middle of the 19th century, provoked by such the events as the Indian Sepoy Uprising, and then also by an uprising in Jamaica a few years later. And so I focused upon this transition. And I would say, quite frankly, that the earlier period, the period of John Stuart Mill and Macaulay, was a period in which liberalism justified itself by saying that we are going to transform India and make it a major free country. But we have to work at it. It's going to be necessary for us to do it. And Mill even made up a list of colonies which he thought should be transformed, India being at the top of the list. Then during the 1850s, there was this uprising, which I said, the Sepoy Mutiny it's called, and also others in Jamaica, and that disillusioned liberals. Now, people have said the liberals were hypocrites to begin with. They really always thought empire needed justification, and there was a hypocritic style of justification. For myself, I thought these people, Macaulay and Mill and such people, were honest. That is to say that they believed what they said they were doing. But after the revolt, disillusionment set in, even amongst liberals. And so you get a late 19th century liberalism in which the empire was seen as a good thing, not because it could transform people into Englishmen, but because they needed stern control, that they were inferior, they had not the capacity to become like the English. And so therefore the English could say, well, we have liberalism at home, but in a place like India, you need an authoritarian style of liberalism in which you rule people harshly. And most of my career has been investigating aspects of that late century illiberal liberalism in the empire through various media. I've studied British colonial architecture and political ideology more generally, people like James Fitzjames Stephen. And so I'd say that is where my career has primarily been. And India has always been the focus of it. For a time, and I was during the 1970s, for instance, economic development and close to the ground studies of peoples was predominant. And during that era, I worked on the impact of empire on a particular group of Indians, landlords in the north. But I eventually drifted back to imperial ideologies and the way the British implemented or thought about or used these ideologies in India. Now that sort of brings me up to the point which we start thinking about this book. Mm-hmm. A lot of things sort of came together. For one thing, quite personally, I was tired of just going to India. I wanted to see other places. Secondly, I knew, because I had often been to these places, the Indians were all around the Indian Ocean era, and even, of course, in the Caribbean, as indentured laborers and other jobs. replacing slavery. There was one famous book which said that indentured laboring was simply slavery in a new way. And again, I wanted to find out how that worked and what that meant. I remember the day I was in the city of Madras and saw the architecture of the Raj. I said, this interests me, and nobody's ever done any research on it. And so that, like I said, the architecture book was quite separate. But now this book on the imperial connections pulled together a number of things which were beginning to become interesting to me. One was the larger question of Indian Ocean or oceanic studies more generally, world history, comparative history. I thought it would be useful to set the Raj, which was always my major area of interest, in that larger connection. And also, also it seemed that India played a role, and this was became somewhat a controversial part of my work, a role in this Raj that was not just a colony dangling on the end of a string going back to London. It seemed to me that India was such a central player that one even might call it a sub-imperial enterprise of its own. In other words, the British who went out to India did not settle there permanently, but they adopted a point of view which often involved that the Indian government, the Indian people, and the Indian economy was just the most central player determining what happened in the Indian Ocean. And if you wanted to look at the larger context of the Indian Ocean, you had to look at India as the central player in this whole enterprise, because it was big. It was in the middle of the Indian Ocean. It was logically a major player. So I wanted to see what role India played as a what I would call a sub-imperial player. Now, this involved a number of different categories, which one can look at as we go along. But I should think that, want to say that one element, which was always very delicate and very tricky, was to ask to what extent were Indians active players in the sub-imperial enterprise? And that's a delicate question, because often people would think of them as colonial subjects, and that was it. And you know, you come to Gandhi and you get Indian independence. But Gandhi also went to South Africa. Gandhi also was a player in this game, and as an active participant, not just as a mobilizer of anti-imperial opinion. And studying Gandhi in South Africa also, I think, helped to make me think about just what's going on here. And so I set out to develop and study the various groups of Indians who participated in this larger enterprise, which I would call the sub-imperialism of India in the Indian Ocean. And that led me in this book, I have chapters on the indentured laborers in the cane fields. That was a very tricky question, because these people often were very poor. They were often subject to coercion on the plantation, which was not that different from what you would see in a slave plantation. And yet they signed up, they went, quote unquote, out of free choice. And unlike slaves, they had a term at the end of which they were free to do what they wished. And so I try to point out that however they were coerced in the initial era, they did have freedom of choice at the end of the expiry of their contracts. And lots of people also went to India for other reasons. Went to Africa or Southeast Asia for other reasons. And so one of the things I tried to do in this book is to look at the institutions which facilitated making India a central player, and also at the role the Indians played in this larger enterprise. So maybe I'll stop there and you can move on to other questions if you'd like.
Yes, thank you for starting talking about the Raj book and talking about the role of India. So I would like to ask you and retract to think about how does your book fit into the larger historiography of India? What does the Indian Ocean mean for South Asianists?
Well, it meant a lot. That's it. It meant a lot in the period of what I call the early modern era, from say 1500 to 1800. In those years, you see, the conquest of Clive. You see the trading companies, and the Indian Ocean was obviously central to the opium trade to China. The Indian Ocean was very central to those years and the contest between Britain and France. And after the Indian Ocean and the entire area was put under British rule, people didn't think so much about India in the Indian Ocean. They thought about land tenure. They thought about peasants. They thought about on land. The British ruled hundreds of millions of people. I mean, who cared what happened in the Indian Ocean? The rattles were finished. The trade was changed in nature from commodities like opium and whatnot to simple things like cotton textiles. So it seemed to me that the time had come to think about India in the Indian Ocean. And of course, I was not the only person. A number of volumes were written looking at this larger question, not just from the point of view of the economic history of the earlier period, which there are a lot of famous books that are written on that period. But in the later period.
And your book really fills a lacuna when it comes to the more recent history of the Indian Ocean. I would like to ask you about writing the book itself. What was the research process like and the methodologies you've used in writing it?
Well, the research methodology was classic. Academic history, if you will. I went to the archives and read the documents that I could get my hands on. I spent a lot of time in New Delhi in the Indian National Archives, which I've always enjoyed and was very happy in, actually. And I spent a good bit of time in England, also working both in the Colonial Office records, which are at Kew in the British National Archives, and the India records, which are in the India Office collection in the British library. And I think that says something itself. India was, in the eyes of researchers, separated from the colonial empire. It was all the records were kept totally different. There was no, you couldn't find any reference to Colonial Office records in the British library. I know I've looked. And so I went back and forth to these archives. I also spent a couple of months in South Africa because I wanted to see how the recruitment of Indian laborers for the sugar plantations worked. I mean, it was one thing to talk about a new system of slavery, as one author. It was another thing to find out what was it like. How did it work? I wanted to get the institutional side of these things. And so at Peter Maritzburg, the archives of the Indian, of the then apartheid state, actually, province of Natal. And I also, as I say, I enjoyed going traveling around. It was an excuse to go to Zanzibar and Singapore and such like places. So then I sat down and connected it. I decided I couldn't write a narrative history. It had to be a study of topics because I didn't want to go, well, they did this year and the next year that happened. That would confuse people. So I said, look, I'd want to write about how the sugar recruitment process worked. I wanted to look at how the military recruitment process worked, and then to assess in each of those cases something about, let's say, the role and of Indians. I didn't do much interviewing. I had one amusing interview story, though, because many of the Punjabi six, were very important in the building of the railroad and general in East Africa. So when the six retired, almost never did they go back to India. When the six retired, they were given little farm plots. And then after independence of Kenya, the Kenyan government wanted to get rid of these Indians. And so a lot of them were forced out. They went to England in many cases. But a few were left. And so once I traveled out into the remote interior of Kenya to talk with and the descendant of a sick Indian farmer. But interviewing is not really practical in this kind of a situation.
Mm-hmm. And you draw beautifully from the archives to write about vast regions on large scales. So if you were to think about India as a sub-imperial center, in your assessment, what analytical possibilities does that pose for writing imperial history as generated from India rather than the metropole?
Well, it's hard to know exactly how to respond to that. I mean, you have to look at what the Indians were doing in terms of the empire, and I think that was often been inadequately assessed. And I mentioned Gandhi a few minutes ago, but Gandhi is a classic case of someone who couldn't get a legal employment in Bombay after he finished his training in Britain. And he went to South Africa, where he worked as a lawyer for Indian merchants, and then from there got involved in political activities. And it's interesting to say two things. One is that Gandhi and many of the people, educated Indians of his day, were imperialists avowedly. They thought the British Empire was a good thing. It enabled them to travel and to make money. And it gave them connections, which they utilized, particularly the merchant classes, in addition to and quite apart from the sugarcane of indentured laborers. Lots of them went because they saw the opportunities of the empire. I think one of the things you have to look at is to see how empire could make opportunities for people. And you find that the Indians built the railroads in Kenya. Indians became merchants everywhere, and often educated elites who would travel to various parts of the empire. So in the process, of course, they generated hostility, not just from the local people. And, you know, eventually, as I say, the collapse of this whole system came about in part with the growth of Indian nationalism. Indians became focused on their own freedom struggle. Gandhi came back to India, but also they were looked upon with substantial hostility by all the countries where they had been trading, where they had been doing useful jobs, because the local people saw the Indians taking opportunities which should rightfully, nationalism, bluntly speaking, came and pushed Indians out in most of Africa. And the Southeast Asia as well. Those are the two regions where look at the Indian Ocean from the point of view, you have to think about the empire, you have to think about nationalism, and you also have to think about trade. There was trade all the time going on, even after the demise of the famous trading companies.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Mm-hmm. In your book, in attempting to write the history of all of these colonies from East Asia to Africa, you've deployed the conceptual framework of a horizontal web. So can you explain to us what you mean by that, and how did that help you to narrate this history?
Well, it's not a very complicated idea. The idea is that the colonies were connected to each other through trading, administrative, migratory movements. They were not just connected, each one separately, to Britain. And that's what I mentioned. I mentioned the archives being not connected for India and for the colonies. That's exactly what I was trying to argue against, that there were connections. at one point I make it in the book, I make a sort of a joke. I say, well, it was like a spider web. And then I say, well, is India the spider at the middle of the web? Yes. But there was another bigger spider on the edges, of course, looking in, namely Britain. So I wouldn't want to say the web was completely self-contained. It was an imperial structure. Britain did have the final say. And it's important not to forget that, obviously.
Mm-hmm. So you've mentioned earlier some remarks about the historiography of South Asia. So I would like to ask you, how does your book reassesses the historiography of the Indian Ocean during the colonial era, beyond the common understanding of it as a British lake in the second half of the 19th century?
Well, that's a delicate question. I don't know that I can really answer that, except to say that there were lots of different ways in which it interjected itself, in which contemporary historiography would be involved with this subject. I'm sorry, I really can't answer that question in detail.
I think the book makes very important contributions in thinking about how not just the British were traversing this ocean and generating history, but also people coming from the region of South Asia and being dispersed across this vast space are also taking part in the so-called British Lake, which really shows it as not merely British, right?
Yes, that's my point, is that people, the Asians, particularly the Indians. Now, you can say, well, what about China? The Chinese were also very much involved as traders and as tin miners in Malaya and whatnot. But China was never part of the empire. Hong Kong didn't really have much of an effect on the larger Chinese situation. So if you think about Asians, i.e., that is to say, East Asians, you get a very different perspective than if you think about Indians. East Asians were not functioning within the structures of the empire to quite the same extent. They went to Indonesia, the Philippines, other people's empires. I think a lot of the same things happened, that they provided opportunities for development and growth of commercial agriculture above all else. And ultimately, they became looked upon with disfavor, with hostility, as nationalist movements grew up in Burma, Indonesia, and Philippines, and so forth.
So in thinking about those Asians, you use the concept of colonized colonizers. So how did you conceptualize that, and how did you think of the positionality of those people in the making of the empire in Asia and Africa?
Well, I tried not to make it a simple-minded statement. I mean, people talk about oppressed colonial subjects, and there are plenty of oppressed colonial subjects. And others, the British themselves, talked about all the wonderful opportunities that we make available to our people and the way in which they can become educated and undertake business. And I guess what I tried to do was a series of case studies. I tried to avoid calling the indentured system, as Hugh Tinker had done, quote, a new system of slavery. No, I don't think it was a new system of slavery. But it wasn't exactly an ideal situation either. So I tried, in each chapter, as I said, takes up a different group and tries to assess that group's fate, if you will. I mean, it's hard to talk about groups. Indians, lots of them, hundreds of millions of them, lots of them went overseas for all kinds of reasons. And I think some critics have tried to make me an apologist of the empire, but I'm trying not to do that. I was trying always at every point to see to what extent it offered advantages and disadvantages to those who participated in it. And I guess I'm a bit more of an optimist than some people in that regard, but please don't call me an apologist.
No, definitely. In fact, you problematize a lot of these, which seems to be straightforward connections between the colonized and the colonizers. So the book closes in 1920s. I'd like to ask you, why do you regard the 1920s as a rupture in the web of imperial connections that focused on India?
Well, several things were happening. There was the First World War, though that did not make much of a difference in the empire, though there were some particular cases which alarmed the British to the thought that maybe these Indians were not as participants in the colonizing enterprise as they once were. For instance, a group of six, and they were very regarded as reliable members of the Indian Army, and the Indian Army is very important in this whole enterprise. There was a mutiny, an uprising of six in Singapore in 1915. And that, I think, began to shake British confidence in using such people. I mean, you have to bear in mind the British always were in charge. They always had to decide, well, is this something we want to encourage, or do we not want to encourage it? And so I think that the growth of nationalism in India and in these colonial territories was critical. I mean, the growth of Indian nationalism is quite fascinating in one case, which is the question of the indentured labor. The British had always felt the indentured labor was good. It allowed Indians opportunities, and they stayed on and whatnot. But increasingly, stories of really oppression and extortion, and particularly sexual harassment on these plantations, drifted back to India. And people like Gandhi and others began to say, no, we don't want this. We cannot have our subjects treated like this. They're Indians, and they should not be subject to the kind of exploitation that happened on these plantations. And so then the British eventually began to agree with them and say, well, maybe we could get rid of this altogether. It became apparent, for instance, that you didn't need Indians on these plantations anymore, because it was possible by the 1910s and so thereabouts to get local workers. I mean, you see the beginnings of the apartheid system in South Africa. You put the South African blacks to work on these sugar plantations. You don't need the Indians anymore. So why give? And you create antagonism for yourself. The British did by encouraging these Indians to be there. So you see, the First World War era is important, I think, insofar as you talk about the growth both of Indian nationalism and colonial nationalism, and the British attempt to adjust to these changes. Now, nothing happens right away. It takes a while, but then you have the Great Depression, which increases the sense of nationalism in these colonial territories, and even England itself. And then you have the Second World War, and there you have that traumatic, climactic occasion in which the British in Burma abandoned the millions, literally, of Indians they had encouraged to come there. The British took themselves back to India, where they would not be threatened by the Japanese, and left their Indians, who were their employees, their subordinates, to fend for themselves and to escape, or to be massacred by the Japanese, or in some cases, in the end, to join the Japanese as well. So that was the coup de grace of the system, but it took a while to fade away, I think.
Mm-hmm. The book, since its publication in 2008, have become, I would say, an instant classic. It has been engaged by hundreds of scholars, and that made me think, if you had any engagement with these citations, if you revisited some of the ideas you advanced in this book.
Well, first of all, I retired from active teaching, so that I didn't have graduate students working in this field. Secondly, this book participated in what I call a major historiographical trend of the end of the last century, what is called the New Imperial History. Scholars had studied empire as though it were some special thing, and they'd studied Britain as though it were some special thing also. And the two didn't meet. A famous historian of British labor, E.P. Thompson, was born in India. He was a scion of the British classes in India, but he refused to see it. And then finally, and as I say, my earlier work, I think, Ideologies of the Raj in particular, became representative of a larger historiographical trend in the 1990s called the New Imperial History. And lots of other people, including several of my own students, Dane Kennedy among them, most notably, and others, became interested in making imperial history part of British history. And this became an important new historiographical trend, as I say, which I think really overwhelmed traditional British history all during the 1990s. In fact, people would say, I mean, I sort of say, well, the year I taught the British Empire in the same classroom as the British historian, a well-known, excellent historian, Thomas Le Cur, and I got more students than him. Then I realized that this was something that mattered to people. Empire mattered to people. And the American invasion of Iraq in 2003 also increased interest in this whole field. And that lasted, I think, until the last few years. And finally, it's now been pushed aside by related but somewhat different interests in so-called global history, comparative history, and so forth. I didn't want to talk about comparative history and global history because I felt I had all I could deal with in talking about the British Empire. But now people are interested in larger issues and, of course, quite different issues of all sorts. And since the since then, I've been reading a bit in American history, and it's interesting to see how American history has accommodated the growth of these kinds of concerns. Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you for writing this book. This book has been really helpful for me as a graduate student. And it's amazing how you brought this vast geography in one coherent narrative. And I would like the listeners to listen to some of the passages from the book if you would like to read perhaps the last paragraph of the book.
I'll read the last paragraph. Let me read you one other paragraph, if I might, which is just about the British, the kinds of people who would come to India and be involved in this. I'm sorry. You find one of the things about the Empire is it attracted all kinds of strange, offbeat British people who were ill at ease or uncomfortable. Who you think of Lawrence of Arabia, yeah, some of these were very famous. Others were hardly anybody. Now, I'd just like to read a paragraph about one of the people who's very important for me here. Tristram Charles Sawyer Speedy, 1836 to 1910. Born in Meerut, son of James Speedy, a lieutenant in the 3rd Regiment of Foot, Tristram Speedy was commissioned into the Indian Army in 1854, first posted in Meerut and then in Peshawar. But he resigned his commission, took up a life of wandering adventurer, as I could say here, which took him first to the court of King Theodore of Abyssinia, where he served a time as British vice consul in Eritrea, then to New Zealand, where he enlisted in the local militia that were fighting the Maori, and ultimately back to Abyssinia in 1868, where Lord Napier summoned him to act as interpreter and advisor for the campaign that was to terminate in the siege of the forest of Magdala and the death of King Theodore. After the Magdala campaign, Speedy took charge of the orphaned infant of the king, whom he brought with him to England and subsequently to India, where Speedy secured the post of district superintendent of police in Sitapur. After 2 years in India, Speedy moved on to the Straits, where in 1872 he took up the position of superintendent of police in Penang. He resigned a year later to take up service with a Mantri of Larut, who was the native prince. A month later, he was on his way to Lahore to recruit troops for the Mantri of Larut. And that, I think, gives you a sense of the sort of wandering character. I mean, this is all done in the Indian Ocean. He never went to England. He never had anything to do with England. He worked in this arena, stretching from Malaya to Abyssinia, and of course with recruiting of Indian troops, absolutely central. Let me read the last paragraph, which I alluded to already. The fall of Singapore and Burma to the Japanese in 1942 delivered the final blow, as one devastated officer who joined Bose's Indian National Army, which was fighting with the Japanese against the British, as one devastated officer who joined the Indian National Army, quote, "I was brought up to see India through the eyes of the British officer. At the back of my mind was traditional urge of loyalty to the king." That's the sub-imperial enthusiasm which I talked about. But no longer. With the surrender of the supposedly impregnable fort at Singapore, the entire legitimacy of the Asian Empire had been shaken. Singapore's fall was followed within months by the collapse of British authority in Burma, and the subsequent exodus, hundreds of thousands of Indians fleeing in chaotic disarray with little or no support from the British colonial government, and leaving thousands of dead behind them, the Indians trekked back to Assam through the mud of Burma's jungle-clad hills. Weakened by disease and starvation, they straggled into a country little equipped to receive them and on the verge of a massive famine in 1943. In Burma, the Indian community had depended for its security on that of the British colonial regime. Now its members find themselves betrayed and vulnerable across Southeast Asia. British and Indian had come, as one British officer told his Indian subaltern in Singapore, "the parting of our ways." If the empire had abandoned them, the Indians who had served and prospered under it had no choice but to seek their own destiny. And so, I mean, it's important to bear in mind that there was a lot of this sort of what I call sub-imperialism or colonizing enthusiasms among the Indians, but they could not ever rely upon the British permanently and securely, and of course, with that, the empire's final bell was tolled.
Thank you for reading these passages. I've enjoyed reading the book, and I'm sure many of our listeners would enjoy the book as well. We've taken a lot of your time, and before I close, I would like to ask you, since your retirement, you have been reading and thinking about American imperialism, as you've alluded to. Can you share with us some of your insights on how it compares with the British? I know you've been thinking about the Philippines to reflect on the nature of colonialism and larger ties to racism and power. So if you can talk about these connections.
Okay, yeah. I mean, I might say first a word about the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003. That stimulated a lot of interest in American imperialism. I, of course, was interested in it because I was interested in imperialism already. But suddenly, American empire seemed less something vague and in the past and very much alive and in the present. And of course, we are still stuck in Iraq and Afghanistan. Even with under Trump, the question of out or in or are questions which are very, very, very important today. Despite the pandemic and everything, our American foreign engagement remains that issue, and there are elements of imperialism in it. But let me say a word, as you asked, about the Philippines. And that's a separate case, because 100 years before, that is to say, in 1898, the United States went to war with Spain. I won't get into the details of the war. They conquered Cuba, Puerto Rico, and the Philippines, which were Spanish colonies. And the Americans were suddenly had come face to face with a conundrum, which I described before, of how do you fit together liberalism and empire? How can you make it work? And there were various ways in which the Americans tried to make it work. And I wrote one article which I attempted to try to show how and in what ways they took the British Empire as a model. But I think the important thing to start with is to say that the Americans did not want to take the British Empire as a model. They did not want to be seen. They had a hard time seeing themselves as an imperial power. It was just not. I mean, what is it then? They've kind of taken all the West from the Indians? I mean, this is a kind of an act of self-deception with which Americans have been engaged for a century and more. It's like nowadays, talking about racism, it's embedded in American culture. Well, I think imperialism also is embedded in American culture and part of the same thing as racism at some level. But Americans really, really, really didn't want to accept. And this had several consequences. one of which was that those who did want to accept it, of whom the most important was Theodore Roosevelt, it was a difficult task to convince his fellows that we should actually rule the Philippines like as an imperial society. For one thing, one of the things that the Americans did was to conquer certain strategies of rule in the Philippines, which I won't go into in detail. And they built a little hill station. The British always like to have hill stations for rehabilitation. But they never set up proper colonial service. They were always very much afraid of being seen as an imperial power. And the result was that the classic colonial era of the Americans in the Philippines was hardly a decade or more. By the time Woodrow Wilson, the Democratic Party, was very much anti-imperial. William Jennings Bryan had run two election campaigns against Theodore Roosevelt, both of which he lost. So there was imperial sentiment in the United States at that time. But increasingly, they didn't want to allow it. They didn't want to admit it. And so the Americans did put their liberalism into practice, if you will, a bit more and a bit sooner than the British. The British ruled India for 100 years before there was ever any appreciable Indian political voice in the legislature. In the American case, once Woodrow Wilson came in, this was only 15 years after they conquered Philippines in the first place, they began to hand over power to elite Filipinos, to be sure. And so you can see that American imperialism was always something that made Americans unhappy if it were allowed. And you can say the same thing about racism if you want, but it was there, and it wasn't going to go away. And it had to be hidden. And of course, if you hid it, you did allow the, quote, colonial subjects like the Filipinos a lot more autonomy until they eventually threw the Americans out. But that was not until the 1970s. So it was a long time that the U.S. continued behind the scenes to act as an imperial power. And even in the early days, people felt this was made them uncomfortable. I mean, in Manila, and I think in 1903, I read a report of somebody who said that the colonial government had read the 4th of July Proclamation. And this person who was writing this note said, just read the 4th of July Proclamation to Filipinos. Considering the situation where we are in seemed a little bit odd. It was odd, but it was something the U.S. was determined not to acknowledge. I think I've become a little bit more leftist, if you will, in this whole thing as I've looked closer at since the invasion of Iraq and also thought about some of the parallels with the current concerns about racism. I mean, there's a talk of taking down a Theodore Roosevelt statue. The statue business is an interesting commentary on empire, and I would like to see more people thinking about it instead of just putting statues, dumping them into the river or whatever, because they are very, very telling reminders of a larger, not just slavery, but of a larger imperial enterprise. In Britain, of course, the statue of a slave trader was dumped into the river. I'm not in favor of that, but I am in favor of thinking about your history in the larger context.
That's very useful. Thank you for sharing these insights with us today. And thank you for listening to today's episode in which we explored imperial connections, India, and the Indian Ocean arena, 1860 to 1920, published by University of California Press in 2008. This is your host, Ahmed Al-Mazmi. Stay tuned for the next episode of New Books in the Indian Ocean World.